good evening, good morning, good afternoon, everybody out there. This is Tom Harris in beautiful Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 97. As we creep ever closer to the episode number 100. So anyway, this has been a little bit of a respite here in the last few days from the unbearably hot weather that I've been talking about in the last few shows. And it actually is even reasonably comfortable in here today. It's still quite a bit warmer than I would like, but I do have this tendency to like cooler climates, and this is summertime in Illinois. So, of course, it's a little bit warmer than I'd like, but, you know, hey, it's not as bad as it was last week. Now, the big news, of course, this week, is that the pigeons have flown the coop. So the name of this... This show should probably be Bye Bye Birdies. And as I was talking about in the previous show, I was kind of expecting it soon. And what we noticed was over the past week or so that the babies were coming and going. So sometimes they would be there, sometimes they wouldn't be there. And, for example, in the morning when I would go to work, they wouldn't be around. You wouldn't see them. And then when I would come home in the evening, they would be back there on their little step. Finally, we decided, or one of my neighbors decided, that what she was going to do was try to kind of scare them off and try to keep them from coming back here. Because one of the things about pigeons, and of course anybody who knows anything about pigeons knows, that they home. And they tend to come back to the same places all the time. And apparently one of the ways that you can prevent pigeons from returning to a place where they're not really welcome is to put down sheets of aluminum foil. And I guess the flapping of the foil and the flashing of the foil makes the pigeons not want to stay there. So we did actually spend a couple of days here over this weekend where we had sheets of aluminum foil down on the back stairs, and that seems to have done the trick. So we haven't had any pigeons on the back steps now. Hopefully they won't come back. Hopefully they'll go off and have productive pigeon lives and have more baby pigeons, but not on the back stairs, please. Anyway, that is sort of what's going on as far as the pigeon update goes. So bye-bye birdies, as I said. And we'll move on to something else. For those of you who've been listening to the live show, I have to apologize for the truncated version of the show that went out on Saturday. And it had nothing to do with anything that was happening on this end, but it did have something to do with Ustream. We've been having kind of intermittent problems on Ustream, and it seems that we've been having the problems more with those of us who are here in the States than the ones who are over in England. Not quite sure why that is. Some of the sound was fine on the show as it was going out live, and then all of a sudden I would get this horrible, horrible static, and you couldn't hear anything through the static. And then the sound stream would come back in, and it would all sound fine again, and so forth. And it got to be really apparent as I was going through the show that nobody was able to really listen properly. And I could have muscled through it and done a show, you know, with no callers and no feedback from anybody. But the only feedback that I was getting, to be quite honest, was by people who were telling me that they couldn't hear me. And it was very frustrating. And finally, I decided after the first break at the bottom of the hour that I was just going to call it quits. Because there's no, you know, I don't mind having a live radio show where I don't have callers. I'm prepared to do that usually. I can fill a show with just me talking, and that's fine. And I'll have people occasionally, they'll send along a little text message over Skype or whatever. But when nobody can actually hear the show, it makes me think, well, why am I doing this live? I mean, if I want to do a show that, you know, nobody's actually listening to me while I'm recording it, I might as well be doing a pre-recorded podcast, and then I would have the benefit of editing as I do with this program. So it was a very frustrating situation, but occasionally I guess these things happen. And I just will have to say, you know, next week it'll be better. Hopefully I won't have this problem again. And next week we'll be back to normal. And we can talk about people's personal heroes, which will be the topic of the show. So if you're listening to this right after the show's been posted, and this show is due to be posted on Wednesday of this week, Wednesday the 28th. And if you're listening to it between then and Saturday, then of course you can call into the live show. The live show is broadcast on UnitedKingdomRadio.co.uk every Saturday at 4 p.m. UK time, which is 10 a.m. here in Chicago, would be 11 a.m. on the East Coast of the U.S. Now, as far as this show goes, you can't actually call in or anything, but we do have an email address, and the email address for this show is tom@tomharrisusa.com. And, of course, you can send email, you know, talking about any of the shows, whether it be the live show or this show, and I will funnel the appropriate emails to the appropriate shows and read them out. And, of course, I do appreciate all the feedback that I get, whether it's by email or audio file or whatever. I don't always play audio clips on the show. Part of that is because a lot of times the audio clips would require me to cover material that I've already covered. And I don't like to repeat myself too much. I know I do it probably more often than I want to admit, but I do want to keep the show relatively fresh as far as content and not revisit old topics too often. And of course, I do appreciate all the feedback regardless. And usually if I don't respond to a clip on the show, I will at least respond to it privately, either by voice file or by email. So last time around, I did a little segment called Tom's Travels, because I've actually traveled quite a few places over the years. Travel is one of my passions, and I do hope that that's well received. I mean, I haven't had any feedback one way or the other on that segment, but I'm going to do another one this week, and this week I'm going to be talking about Austria, and we'll come to that in just a few minutes. So another news around here, I think those of you who are listening to the live show on Saturday, I might have mentioned this already, but normally what happens before I go on the air on Saturday is I will, you know, before listening to Chris Reardon, of course, who comes on before me on Saturday usually, I'll go down to the local coffee shop and grab a coffee, and I'll have my coffee before my show and also during my show. Usually by the end of my show, I'm done with it. And I mentioned this week that the coffee shop, when I went there, was inexplicably closed. Well, unfortunately, it does seem as though that's permanent. And that's a real shame because the little coffee shop, which is called Café Ennui, has been there ever since I've been living here in Chicago. And it has really been a fixture here in Rogers Park. And I really am hoping that, you know, eventually that we'll get something to substitute for it. But they closed very suddenly without any kind of warning at all. They were supposed to have an event going on Saturday, which they would normally, you know, it's one of their regular weekly things that they would do down there. But it does seem as though they were shut down or closed down very, very quickly, and they're out of there now. And probably faster than any other business I've seen go out of business here in Rogers Park. But there is at least one other coffee shop that's not too far from me. I don't like them as well. Never have quite liked them as well. But I guess I have no choice now. Hopefully another coffee shop will open somewhere soon, because that seems to be the way it works in this neighborhood. That there, we never have to deal with just one coffee shop for long. And we've, you know, one will close and another one will open. We always have roughly two of them in the neighborhood. And hopefully that will happen again, because a little bit of competition is good. There's nothing wrong with the other coffee shop, I suppose. It's not quite as good, I think, as far as the actual coffee itself. But I guess we'll see what happens. And incidentally, you know, I've been meaning to talk about this for a while now, and I keep forgetting to do so. It's just funny how occasionally a topic will come up like this, and I'll just kind of forget to mention it. Some time ago, speaking of coffee shops, some time ago on the program, I was talking about a new political movement in this country that I thought looked really interesting, and that was something called the Coffee Party. Now, a lot of people have heard about the Tea Party movement here in the States. If you're not from the States, you cannot really appreciate the insanity of the Tea Party movement until you've seen it up close. And I know people who are involved in the Tea Party movement, and not all of them are nuts, but enough of them are nuts that make me think that anybody who is affiliated with the Tea Party movement is going to end up on the worse end of things. As far as, you know, getting into power or whatever. But anyway, I don't want to talk about them. But some time ago, I was talking about this coffee party thing. And the coffee party was set up to be, I guess in some ways, a more intellectual and reasonable version of the Tea Party, addressing a lot of the same issues. Now, one of the things that I've noticed, you know, is that they have seemed to have largely disappeared from the local scene. I know that there are coffee party meetings here in Chicago, and I know that there's one that's local to me. Then they would gather about 40 people a week. But they've been surprisingly quiet as far as activities or policy statements or anything of that nature. And I was afraid of that. And I think if you go back to the show, you'll see that I kind of had my doubts and kind of had fears that what was going to happen is that they were just going to kind of talk and not really do anything. And so I am kind of disappointed to say that that seems to be right. That seems to be what's happened here. The coffee party seems to, at least as far as my local area, to have become sort of a support group for people who find the Tea Party movement odious in their tactics and in their policies. Now, what has happened, and you've been following the news at all, the Tea Party movement has started to kind of fracture a bit because you've actually have the mainstream of the Tea Party is the Republican Party. There's really no question of that. It's not even really debatable. I mean, they only support Republican candidates. They only support Republican policy statements. And not surprising because it is an AstroTurf movement. It was created by a political action committee that was founded by Dick Armey, who was one of the, you know, Republican leaders in the House of Representatives some years ago, back in the 90s. So it has always been a conservative Republican organization, and now even more so. And what has kind of happened is the Tea Party has started to show off their crazy a little bit and has started to drive away any sort of moderate conservative Republican people from it. And they have been supported only the most extreme of the right wing candidates. And it's part of this mindset, and I've talked about this as well before, where when Republicans lose elections, it's never the fault in their own minds. It's never the fault of the policies being promoted. It's never the fault of conservatism. If anything, they feel that the reason why they lost is because they aren't conservative enough. And they always place the blame for losing elections on, well, they tried to be too liberal. They tried to be too centrist. And what has happened now is that that mindset has become codified within the Tea Party movement. And as I think you're going to see in this next election, that these Tea Party candidates who are coming up are going to get thwomped hard. And I don't know what's going to happen because some of these people do kind of spout the sort of, you know, if we can't win at the ballot box, then we're going to, win through the Second Amendment method, which sort of implies, violence, taking up of arms. And I think that they certainly have the wrong idea. And the coffee party was sort of devoted to this idea that government is not the enemy, that government is something that can work for everybody, and civility within government is the most important thing. So I had high hopes for this, and I'm kind of sorry to see that it really hasn't gone anywhere nationally. We do, I belong to a coffee party, the main coffee party Facebook site, and also the Chicago area coffee party Facebook site. But it doesn't seem like they're doing much other than talking. And that's unfortunate. I would really kind of rather see them take a more active part and try to really do what they say they're intended to do. And that is to continue to try to create more of an atmosphere of civility in the political discourse. But it's hard to do when people aren't paying attention to you and they don't have the theatricality and so forth that the Tea Party movement does. Anyway, that's just my kind of thought. So, I am a little bit disappointed by that, but what do you do? I mean, I don't have the time or the energy to be part of the leadership of this movement, and I don't know that I could do anything about it even if I could. Even if I did have time to get heavily involved in that. I think that it's not a sexy idea, and it's hard for people to get involved with because it's not dramatic. Civility isn't dramatic. And, I mean, any playwright will tell you that what drives drama, what drives a story, what drives a narrative that makes people interested is conflict. And the Tea Party provides that and the Coffee Party doesn't. So, a real shame there. Anyway, that's enough for that little digression. Alright, so in the second half of the show, I'm going to do another edition of Tom's Travels. I should probably do a jingle or something for that. I'm going to be doing them more or less in alphabetical order. That's just kind of how I've decided to do it. Now, last time I did Amsterdam, this time I'm doing Austria, which means the next time is probably going to be Belgium. But I'm obviously sometimes I'm going to be doing just a city, and sometimes I'll be doing an entire country, as the case with Austria here. And I think that that's because sometimes a major city, such as Amsterdam or Rome or London, you know, can certainly hold their own little 15-minute segment, and there's a lot to talk about. Now, Austria only has one city that I think can really handle a segment on its own, and that would be Vienna. And so I will eventually be doing Vienna down the road. But Austria, of course, you know, for the people who aren't aware of where it is, it's in the kind of the corner of Central Europe, kind of southeast of most of Germany, kind of tucked in there, borders on also the Czech Republic and Hungary, among other places. And it is very culturally tied to Germany in a lot of ways. Now, obviously, they're a German-speaking country. And in a lot of ways, it's very, very similar. And, of course, you have, it's a smaller country and is dominated on the north and the west part of the country by the Alps. And, of course, the mountains are a wonderful reason to go to Austria to begin with. Now, a lot of famous people have come from Austria. You know, it's the nation of Mozart. It's the nation of Strauss. The nation of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And also, of course, you know, such infamous people as Jörg Haider, Adolf Hitler, and Kurt Waldheim. So Austria is not a sort of a squeaky clean kind of country in a lot of ways. However, it was the seat of the Habsburg Empire. You know, it was referred to as the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Austria was obviously a major part of that. So, of course, it was a major seat of power for hundreds and hundreds of years of European history. Now, the first time I went to Austria was in 1980 when I was 17 years old. This was right out of high school and my very first trip to Europe. And it was one of my favorite places. Now, a lot of that had to do with the mountains, because I've always been a sucker for mountains. I've loved mountains. And Austria has them in abundance. Now, the area that I spent the most time in regards to that, would be Innsbruck. Now, Innsbruck is a kind of a charming little town. It has a lot of pretty well-preserved medieval buildings, some of which I believe are of dubious authenticity. I think that, you know, they would burn down or whatever and they would rebuild them in the medieval style. But that's okay, because it actually is a fairly little, pretty little town center. There's not a ton to do in Innsbruck during the summer. The real reason why people go to Innsbruck is to go skiing. And of course, they've had the Winter Olympics in Innsbruck several times. Now, Innsbruck, as Austria goes, is pretty expensive. And Austria itself, I think, in general, is very expensive. I find Austria to be probably the most expensive country in Europe. And that's saying a lot, and especially when you consider that my second trip to Austria, I actually came after having been in Switzerland, which I know a lot of people think is the most expensive place in Europe. They're both expensive, obviously, but I think Austria is even a little bit more. Which is not to say that Austria doesn't have a lot of charm. Of course it does. It has, you know, the Schönbrunn Palace. It has, of course, Vienna with all the museums and so forth. And Vienna, like I said, will get its own little segment eventually. So I won't go into too much detail about Vienna. But my first visit really concentrated on Salzburg. Now, Salzburg, for those people who are not aware, is in, you know, sort of the central part of northern, kind of central part of Austria. It's a big salt mining region, hence the name Salzburg, which means salt city or city of salt. And salt is still mined there today. Now, back in 1980, when we first went there, and I was with a group of people, obviously, we went to the salt mines, and there's a number of them still active in the area of Salzburg. And they're quite interesting, really, in the way that they kind of do things there. That's definitely something that you would want to see if you're in the area. And I know we took a bus out there. I mean, it was not, like, right in town. And it was actually, I think the salt mine that we went to was just over the border in Germany, in a little place called Berchtesgaden. You may have heard it, because we actually visited the Eagle's Nest while we were there in Berchtesgaden, which was Hitler's kind of home away from home. But getting back to the salt mines, they're pretty cool places, actually, and the way they work in Austria, at least in that particular mine that we were in, is that they pump these underground hollows that they kind of carve out of the salt, and they pump these things full of water, and then just let the water sit there, and the water will leach, you know, the salt will leach into the water, making the water very briny, and then they drain the water out, they extract the salt from that, and then they pump water back in again, and they continue this process, and of course these spaces get bigger and bigger and bigger over time, and eventually they would, you know, merge with other spaces nearby and so forth. And it's all very, very interesting and technical. And you get to ride in little trains, little trolleys that run through these things. They give you a special kind of jumpsuit and a funny little fez type hat. And they also have a couple places where you slide down basically these giant banisters. Well, they're actually meant for people to slide down to get from one level of the mine to another. So in a way, it's a very touristy thing to do. And you could have your picture taken as a group if you're in a group of you sitting on this little trolley waiting to go in. And I thought that was a lot of fun. Now it's very touristy, like I said. But the reason why there a lot of these touristy things exist is because people like them. They're popular. And that's why they become touristy. If people didn't like doing it, they wouldn't offer the service. So I don't feel bad always doing these sorts of really touristy things. Now, Salzburg itself is kind of a dingy place. It is, of course, the home of Mozart, which you're reminded of at every turn. Everywhere you look, there's a marker or a sign or something which proclaims the city as being the home of Mozart. And, of course, the many souvenir shops where you can buy, you know, Mozart-themed goodies to your heart's content, including, of course, the infamous Mozart chocolates. And for those of you who haven't had the pleasure of trying the Mozart chocolates, they're sold in every souvenir store. They're these little round chocolate spheres wrapped in aluminum foil with a picture of Mozart on it. And sometimes they have a truffle filling, and sometimes they're just like a solid chocolate. Usually they're very, very stale, and they have about the taste and consistency of your average candle. I generally would say avoid these at all costs. It's the sort of thing, kind of like a fruitcake, that you only give to people who you really don't know what else to get them. And certainly you wouldn't eat them for your own enjoyment. Now, people of my parents' generation, and some of you out there who may be a little bit older than I, will remember Salzburg more for its being the setting for the movie The Sound of Music. And, of course, for those who are Sound of Music geeks, you know, there are plenty of things involved. You know, you can go around and see the various places where they filmed the movie. You can run down the hill that Julie Andrews ran down, and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to do there that's related to both Mozart and to The Sound of Music. Now, the big attraction to me in Salzburg, being the history buff that I am, has nothing to do with music at all, whether it's The Sound of or, you know, various composers. The main attraction for me in Salzburg, and the thing that created the biggest impression on me at the age of 17, was Hohensalzburg, which is the castle, medieval castle, which dominates the hilltop over the city. And it's a very, very well-preserved medieval castle. They have often said it's the best-preserved one in Europe, but obviously they haven't been to Windsor Castle, if they want really a well-preserved castle. But anyway, the Hohensalzburg is a very interesting trip. It's worth the hike up the mountain to actually go and see. I don't remember it costing very much to get in, probably typical of museums and so forth in Europe, which is probably about $10 American, or, you know, about £5 or £7.50 British or something. But I did find it very interesting, and it has all the usual features that your average medieval castle has. Now, a lot of people who are in Europe, they've seen castles a dime a dozen, but I do think the Hohensalzburg was pretty exciting. Now, as for Salzburg itself, there is a fair amount of nightlife. I wouldn't really call it a party town, but there are some nice little beer halls and things there. My first time there in 1980, I actually was dared to drink a liter of Austrian beer, which I then proceeded to do. But I'm not a beer drinker, and I don't really like beer, and that was certainly no exception. But the name of the bar was the Ratskeller, and I think it's a pretty famous bar there in Salzburg. Now, moving on to Innsbruck, I talked about that a little bit already. The real reason to go to Innsbruck is, like I said, is to go skiing. And they had the Winter Olympics there a number of times. And it has a very sort of charming pseudo-medieval feel to it. And I say pseudo-medieval because it's just a little bit too Disneylandish. And it is, of course, a big draw during the winter for people who are into skiing. But it has a setting right in the Alps that I find to be just incredibly scenic, and it makes me feel relaxed. I really enjoyed Innsbruck. We kind of passed through there in 1980, and it was enough that many years later, I was reminded of that little stop that we made in the mountains there. I think it was a rest area just outside of Innsbruck with a beautiful view of the valley below where the town is. Now, there are a lot of, during the summer, there are a lot of hiking trails. Now, these hiking trails, they basically go up through the ski areas. But, of course, during the summer, there's not snow up there. And I did take the opportunity when I was there to actually climb up one of the mountains near town. And this particular mountain was called the Hefelekar. And it does have a ski resort on it. And I was able to climb up all the way up to the top. It took about 6 hours to get up there. There's kind of three separate paths that you can take to get up to the top of most of these hills. There's usually an easy path, which takes a much, much longer time, a medium path, which takes about, you know, five or six hours, and then there's a very difficult path, which is kind of basically straight line up the mountain. Obviously, you want to stick with a path that's going to track with your fitness level and how much time you have. And I think that's really what you'd need to look at if you're going to be climbing up a mountain in Innsbruck. And of course, it does take a long time to climb up to the top, but the views are worth it, especially if you have a nice clear day. Now, the day I was up there was a little bit hazy, but not too bad. And you could get a very nice panorama of all of the surrounding peaks, and you'll see down in the valley, and there's a river that runs through the valley. I don't remember the name of the river right offhand. And of course, you can see the mountains across the valley, and there's other ski areas over there, and a cable car actually that goes up the far side. I didn't really bother going up there. I generally try to avoid the cable cars in favor of actually hiking up a mountain, though I've occasionally taken cable cars to the top of a mountain and then hiked down. But that's just sort of me being lazy. But anyway, I thought Innsbruck was, in fact, I can describe it as being a charming little town, though albeit very expensive, as I found all of Austria to be. Now, when I was in Innsbruck, I stayed in a youth hostel, and I would not stay there again. It wasn't the sort of place that I would stay. However, I have no idea how much a pension or a hotel would cost. Probably pretty expensive, I would guess. And of course, you can talk about, you know, Salzburg and Vienna in this kind of the same breath. I mean, I think it's just kind of generally kind of expensive in Austria. Austrian food, nothing special. Pretty much the same as Germany and most other places in Central Europe. Not very vegetarian friendly, though. I will say in closing here that I'm probably the first person ever to go to Vienna solely to do laundry. That's kind of another story, and we'll get to that in a few episodes when I talk about the Czech Republic. Anyhow, getting to be the end of the show, email as always as tom@tomharrisusa.com. This is Tom in Chicago, Illinois, signing off. We'll see you next time.